Genius.
The fully realized vision of an authentic American genius.
We need your brain.
Don't you have a brain in your head?
Oh, then I will have to adjust your brain a bit.
Every day, Billy the Brain talks with the best guests in America.
Cool.
About business.
The boss that works for you.
Entertainment. Sports.
Turning now to sports.
And the local community.
Radio keeps its eye on local events.
It's time for brainstorming.
My brain is like mush.
With Billy the Brain.
Sounds like fun. Let's go.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Our theme today is bad, and my next guest, you might call him the Freddy Krueger of sports writing. His slash-and-burn style leaves no doubt where he stands on the issues. In his latest book, Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Game We Love, he humorously presents the facts about sports business that many of us are too uninformed or too naive to consider. He reveals the negative picture of the modern sports business. If you want to join in the conversation, you can call us at 639-0008, or if you're outside of the county, that's area code 805-639. Named by Unte Reader as one of the 50 visionaries who are changing our world. David Zirin is the host of SiriusXM's radio popular weekly show, The Edge of Sports Radio. He's also a columnist for Nations Magazine, Slam Magazine, The Progressive, and he's a regular op-ed writer right here for our own LA Times. He loves the Mets, the Jets, and the Wizards. Welcome to the show, Dave Zirin. How are you doing today?
Hey, doing great. First, I should tell you it's Zirin.
Zirin, I'm terribly sorry. Is that my mistake? My bad, and I will correct that.
My mom mispronounces it.
Dave Zirin. All right, well, we'll get beyond that. So let's talk about the business of sports, shall we? I mean, at the core, sports really is a business. And in business, you know, it's the duty of the owners to return as much money to the shareholders as possible. How do you comment to that?
Well, I comment that in any business, you also have an accountability and an obligation to the long-term interest of that business. I mean, if not, you're just a slash-and-burn operator, mm-hmm. selling short the what you're trying to create. And that might be fine if you're a day trader, and that might be the accepted culture at Goldman Sachs. But given the fact that sports have been an institution that's bigger than a business in this country, an instrument of social cohesion, an instrument of community, we have to hold them to a higher standard. And right now, they are operating professional sports like a hedge fund. They get a short-term profit, they're very happy, but they don't even realize that they are absolutely smothering the long-term interests of their sports.
All right, well, let's take a look at it. Just a recent example, this just cropped up, and I'm sure you're aware of it, and that is the mm-hmm. Pittsburgh Pirates. Some financial information leaked out about the Pittsburgh Pirates, the lowly Pittsburgh Pirates. They have not had a national championship since, what, 1978? And recently, 79, mm-hmm. they've been pulling up the rear in the National League Central for some time now. But as a business, they turned a profit of $30 million. So, I mean, here is a team that is perennially in baseball and obviously is a perennial loser, but they seem to be making money for their owners. And yet they're not going out of business. It's a small market team, but they seem to be thriving business-wise.
They're thriving. And, you know, it's not just that. They haven't had a winning record, period, in 18 seasons.
Wow. Mm.
And so, and you know, the other thing, too, is you talked about that they are doing well financially. We only know that because of documents that were leaked. In Major League, it's like the WikiLeaks issue with Afghanistan. I mean, Major League Baseball, instead of confronting the incredibly damning information that's coming out about it, what they're doing instead is that they're saying, well, we have to prosecute whoever leaked this information because it's so embarrassing. I mean, if it was just about making a profit and returning a good investment to their shareholders, then these records wouldn't be secret. The Pittsburgh Pirates would be bragging about it. They would be saying, look at us, 18 years without a winning record, and we still make money hand over fist.
Mm.
But they're not doing that because it's an embarrassment, and it shows that what they're doing is gaming the system, gaming taxpayers, taking money from the public till to subsidize their organization, making massive profits, and not even using that money to provide a team worth a damn.
Hmm. Now, it's interesting. We're talking about baseball, and we're talking with David Zirin, everybody. Is that how I pronounce it, David Zirin?
Yep, like a fire siren.
Like a siren, Zirin. His book is Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Game We Love. It's a great book. Pick it up if you're a sports fan. Pick it up if you just want to read some of the humorous and yet stupid things that people are doing today in sports. But, Dave, when I talk to you about this, I want to talk about the business of sports. Congress really made sports, in particular baseball, a virtual monopoly. Aren't we just seeing the effects of monopolistic business practices?
Oh, absolutely. No, this is the fruits of antitrust agreements. And yet the fact that they're protected by antitrust agreements from revealing their true financial information, because that's really the number one thing that the antitrust exemption allows them to do, the greatest part of that. Means that they can hide all their financial particulars, not just from the public, but from the Players Association, from the union. And the problem, though, is they're also an institution that takes billions of dollars in corporate welfare. Now, my six-year-old daughter could see a contradiction in these two facts, that you have an antitrust exemption, which gives you a degree of privacy and protection. Okay, I accept the fact that some businesses need that or require that. But then at the same time, accepting billions of dollars in corporate welfare so they can't be accountable for what they're doing with that antitrust exemption, for what they're doing with the public money. I mean, if any other business operated this way, it would be an absolute scandal. And yet in baseball, we've become so acclimated to it that one of the arguments I make in the book is that it's kind of primed the pump for similar situations like the bank bailout in this country. You know, where you spend $800 billion, some put them figured over $1 trillion, to bail out the banks, we socialize the debt, we socialize their crisis, the profits become privatized, and now we see that, you know, they're not even lending money back to us. Imagine, though, if we didn't know that they weren't lending money back to us. I mean, imagine if banks were allowed legally to say, wow, we took that bailout money and we're lending money left and right. And we had to accept that as fact without seeing any documentation to prove that. That's what Major League Baseball is like.
Very good. We're talking to Dave Zirin, everybody, author of the book Bad Sports. And let's continue in the headlines. Not quite as topical as the Pittsburgh Pirates, but certainly something that's happened in the last couple of weeks. George Steinbrenner, the owner of the New York Yankees, recently passed away. As sports team owners go, how would you rate Mr. Steinbrenner?
Well, I talk about Steinbrenner as being a bridge. I think the best way to – I mean, Steinbrenner is – almost too big to just sort of assess as being a good owner or a bad owner. Like, his social import and his impact on sports is just too mammoth for that kind of very sort of small ball assessment. I mean, he really was a bridge between the old school style of owner that felt a sense of accountability to community and the new school style of owner who would threaten to move the team unless they got public money from the city. And who incorporated things like sweetheart cable deals, luxury boxes, personalized seat licenses, and using your team as well as a place to gain political influence, as in inviting all the big political heads of state to go in the owner's box and all kinds of perks that go along with that. I mean, in so many ways, Steinbrenner really created a mold for modern ownership, but then didn't have the courtesy to break the mold, because I would argue that sports has suffered for all of that. But he was also a bridge to an old-style kind of owner. And just to be clear, I don't look at that old-style owner like the Charlie Comiskeys, the Charlie Finleys, all those folks. I don't look back on them with rose-colored glasses. It just was a very different economic model that they lived in. I mean, back in the day, you had a successful team financially if you put butts in the seats.
Right.
That was how you measured your bottom line. And so on just a basic economic level, whether you were a good guy, a bad guy, whether you loved fans, hated fans, whether you collected puppies, or whether you kicked them down the street, it didn't matter what kind of person you were. You didn't turn a profit unless you were accountable to the hardcore fan who would buy a ticket and go to the game.
All right,
today's model is completely different. Today, you make money if you get tax money. Today, you make money if you have a sweetheart cable deal. I mean, the fan has become so deprioritized in the financial process that I think all of sports has suffered for it.
Well, I would agree with you. We're talking to David Zirin, everybody. His book is Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Game We Love. And let's talk about the Holy Trinity, as you refer to them in the book, and that is the revenue streams that American sports franchises get. The Holy Trinity of public funds for stadium, corporate sponsorships of both the stadiums and the boxes, and, of course, television rights. How did we get so far askew with this new financial model compared to the old financial model of putting butts in the seats?
Well, I think it's very connected to the destruction of a manufacturing base in our cities in this country. Because you have cities across this nation that used to have factories in the cities, that used to have manufacturing that had middle class and working class stable families built around this industry. And when those industries disappeared over the 20-year period from the 70s through the 90s, stadium construction was really held up as a kind of public, bipartisan public works project that would be a substitute for anything resembling a real urban policy in this country. And so, you know, I calculate the number at a very low figure, $30 billion. If you include tax breaks, you can make it a much bigger number if you wanted to do that. But that's been the money that's been put towards stadium construction. And look at what used to be our proudest industrial cities. I mean, places like Detroit, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Milwaukee. I mean, I've been to all those cities, and what they all have in common is shuttered factories and gleaming new stadiums. The problem, though, is, first of all, it's bad policy. It doesn't make a return on its investment. We now know that for a fact. It's bad economics. It's bad for cities. It's bad for communities. It doesn't create stable jobs. Everything they promised is complete BS. But what it also did was it set off, I think, an unintended byproduct of this, Brain, was that it set off a kind of stadium arms race where you felt like, if you're an owner, that you couldn't compete with the other person if they had a publicly funded stadium and you didn't. So it became a measure of your financial solvency instead of what it was first at least purported to be, which was a way to revive and rebuild our cities.
I love it. A stadium's arms race. I made note of that because that's an interesting, interesting term that you use. We're talking to Dave Zirin, everybody. He's the author of the book Bad Sports. Dave, we got a break just briefly for some commercials. But when we do, I want to tease the audience with this question. My producer, Tom Spence, he fired the Dodgers when they acquired Manny Ramirez because of steroid uses. When we come back, let's talk about steroid use in baseball. We'll be back after this short break.
And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
It turns the brains into guacamole.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. I'm Bill Frank, your host, and we are talking to Dave Zirin, who's the author of Bad Sports, right here on KKZZ AM 1400. Dave, before we broke and went to commercial, I brought up the issue of steroid use. Tom Spence, my producer, fired the Dodgers because they got Manny Ramirez. Now, he may be on his way out, but because of his steroid use. And my question to you is, what is the owner's responsibility or part in this steroid scandal in baseball?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. Maybe you and I together can discuss to what degree they're culpable. But one thing that's outrageous is currently the culpability level in the eyes of the media and in the eyes of Congress and the eyes of fans ranks somewhere between zero and zero. And that, to me, is outrageous. I mean, if we agree that steroids have been a PR black eye for the game, if we agree that steroids have hurt the integrity of the sport, if we start at that point, then think about any other industry if they had this kind of black eye affixed to them. I mean, you would be looking to ownership for accountability of how things got where they got. I mean, think about the British Petroleum oil spill. I mean, you wouldn't have congressional hearings where you had oil rig workers dragged in front to discuss their accountability, or the scandals on Wall Street. You wouldn't talk to a guy who is a day trader. No, you'd want to talk to the CEO of Goldman Sachs. And yet in sports, it's been the players who've been dragged in front of the hot lights. Now, I'm not saying for a second that players don't carry a measure of accountability in this process, but I am saying that it is breathtaking to me that not one owner was ever called to testify in front of Congress. It is breathtaking to me that Bud Selig has been the commissioner through this scandal and still has a job. I am shocked that Bud Selig is not only gainfully employed, but they're unveiling a damn statue of him in front of the ballpark, Miller Park, after Miller Beer, where the Brewers play, which, by the way, was another publicly funded stadium boondoggle.
That's right.
And so I think we need to say to players, if they're busted and they're asked to apologize, like Manny Ramirez was, he was asked to publicly apologize, I would say, look, I will apologize the day that the ownership in Major League Baseball also issues an apology, and not only that, but also writes a big old fat check for all the money that they made in the 1990s. And make no mistake about it, we're talking billions of dollars built on the back of the home run.
And the home run, you're going to say, is an extension of steroid use. That was the era of juice led to the era of home runs.
Actually, in the book, I argue that that's even like an overly simplistic way to look at it, because when we talked about these publicly funded stadiums. Mm-hmm. We're talking over two-thirds of parks got new stadiums after 1990. These stadiums were largely considerably smaller than the previous parks. So owners themselves also rigged the game. They also rigged it with taking away the high strike, instructing umpires to make the strike zone smaller. I mean, the juicing of the ball, the switching from ash to maple bats. I mean, they did so many things to really, I would argue, just vulgarize the statistical integrity of the game. And steroids, and actually not just steroids, but just the concept of modern weightlifting are things that are very new to Major League Baseball. And steroids are certainly a part of that. Obviously, they're the most illegal part of that. But the game has been changed by the people who are in charge with safeguarding the game. Like, if you have any baseball fans out there listening to the show, they're going to know exactly what I'm talking about when I say Willie Mays 1954 World Series. Famous over-the-shoulder
pass mm-hmm.
off Dick Wirtz.
Mm-hmm.
His back to home plate, running full speed, somehow catching the ball. You know how far away from home plate he was when he caught that ball?
I forget how far.
460 feet. That would be a home run now in every single ballpark in the major league.
That's right. Yeah, but that was one of the quirky issues of the Polo Grounds, too, before they tore it down. I mean, that was just one of the – and ballparks were all non-uniform, as they are today. But you're just saying the moving into the walls helped to jack up the number of home runs.
Mm-hmm. You're right about that. I mean, in other parks, like in Bobby Thompson's, to talk about someone who just passed away, his famous shot heard around the world in 1951, I mean, that was a barely 300-foot home run. I mean, it wouldn't have been a home run in many other parks. And it was very quirky back then.
Yeah.
But there was something very, very focused and concentrated about these new parks. I mean, they're like the size of Rush Limbaugh's bathtub.
And funny plug for Dave Limbaugh, who was our guest earlier today. Thank you for that. I appreciate
the
plug.
I kind of knew that.
I know you did. So listen, in your book, you write about the Mitchell Report on steroid use in baseball. You called it a sanctimonious fraud. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's, oh my God, don't get me started on the Mitchell Report. George Mitchell, of course, former Democratic Majority Leader of the U.S. Senate out of Maine, a person who's given a great deal of credit for brokering the peace deal in Ireland. But, you know, the other thing about George Mitchell is that he's on the board of the Boston Red Sox.
Hmm.
He's on the board of ESPN. It made no sense to have him head something like this up. And it eventually what he came out with was something that, if it wasn't for the revelations inside about Roger Clemens, it would have gone and been forgotten within 24 hours. I mean, I thought it was an absolute joke. It was Major League Baseball trying, Bud Selig, classic Bud Selig, like being reactive, responding to public pressure, trying to do something to show something. But I can't believe that people don't talk about the fact that two of the biggest names, I would argue the two biggest names that have come out since the Mitchell Report, two of the three biggest names, certainly, because A-Rod's name came out as well. But what have the other two big names been? Manny Ramirez, David Ortiz, not mentioned in the Mitchell Report. George Mitchell, on the board of the Boston Red Sox. I mean, it doesn't take a conspiracy theorist here to say that he was compromised when he revealed the 100 names of people who he said felt were implicated in the world of in steroids.
Yeah. Your book, Bad Sports, Dave Zirin, is just a fun read. I found it very entertaining. Could not put the book down. You really profile some wild and wacky ownership stunts. Let's just talk about the Baltimore Orioles, Camden Yard, and their owner, Kevin Millar. Tell us a little bit about
Peter
what
Angelos.
You think of him.
Yeah. Peter Angelos.
Peter Angelos. Sorry.
Yeah, Angelos. I mean, first of all, Angelos was really one of the inspirations for the book because my wife's from Baltimore, and the Oriole way actually meant something to her and to her family. And it's this idea that said, you know what? We're not the Yankees. We're the Orioles. We're not going to be able to outspend people.
Mm-hmm.
What we're going to do instead is build on the basis of our minor league system, on the basis of fundamentals, and on the basis of building a very, very tight relationship between us and our fan base. And Peter Angelos, who's a lifelong Orioles fan, he got a hold of Camden Yards, started to make money hand over fist, and he went from being the hometown boy made good to being somebody who decided he wanted to be George Steinbrenner Jr. And it used to be that Camden Yards was the hottest ticket in town. When I moved to D.C., Baltimore area, in the mid-1990s, I mean, it was literally a waiting list to go to a baseball game. Now you and I could go, Brain, sit on opposite sides of the stadium and have a conversation between pitches.
Mm.
It's really a kind of upsetting development.
I bet it.
One of the things that Angelos has done, it's one of the most dramatic examples of something that's happened in baseball across the country, which is a complete delinking from the grassroots fan, particularly from kids.
I think you're right. I think it's a very funny story, a funny and peculiar way. We're talking to Dave Zirin, everybody, author of the book
Bad
Sports.
You're in L.A., right?
Yeah, we're in the L.A. market, that's right. We're a little bit north of L.A., a little bit south of Santa Barbara, but we're definitely the L.A. Dodger market up here.
I mean, I've spoken multiple occasions in L.A. high schools about sports and politics,
mm-hmm.
and I always ask, raise your hand if you've been to a Dodgers game this year. Oh, my gosh. I mean, you're talking maybe one out of every 50 kids.
Mm-hmm.
Puts their hand in the air.
Yeah. Well, big major metropolitan area, too. I mean, you talk about the outlying areas. That's 10 million people. So there is a lot there, and Chavez Ravine is only so big. But I get the point that you're making. So that people don't think that your book, Bad Sports, is just about baseball, although we've pretty much dominated the conversation with that, let's talk about another wacky owner here in the L.A. area. That is Don Sterling of the L.A. Clippers. What are your thoughts on him, and why did you write about him in the book?
Donald Sterling, born Donnie Tokowitz from Boyle Heights. I wrote about Sterling because one of the arguments in my book is that there are numerous cases where we could argue that fans and fan owners could actually do a much better job than owners in running the sport, running their teams.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to Donald Sterling and the Clippers, you know, we can say with a totally straight face, hell, it's not like we could do any worse. It's not just that Donald Sterling has overseen a team that some people think might be cursed or built on an old Native American burial ground or something, but it's the most losing team in sports over the last generation, over the last 30 years. No team has lost a higher percentage of their games than the Clippers. And once again, it goes to this question of accountability. What is Donald Sterling's accountability in that process? And also, there's the fact that Donald Sterling is an embarrassment. I mean, it had to pay out the largest housing discrimination settlement in the history of the United States. On the record in open court, having said racist things about every possible ethnicity in the L.A. area. And so, I mean, at some point, we have to start saying, like, look, who do these teams really belong to? I mean, do they belong to the person who owns the title on it, or do they belong to us, to the people who've been passing it down from generation to generation, who scream ourselves hoarse over this stuff? I mean, you want to meet a depressed person, meet a Clippers season ticket holder. and it's like, God bless them, because I've spent some time in L.A. I love the Clippers season ticket holder, because the Lakers folks, I mean, you know, that's like, it's a totally different class. You know, it's like comparing a filet mignon to a cheeseburger, you know?
Mm.
And I guess I'm more of a cheeseburger guy. I think the more hardcore fans, the people who can afford it, they're the ones who go to the Clippers games. And they're treated to misery. I mean, a three-hour Swedish film would be less depressing than going to a Clippers game on most evenings.
I love it. We're talking to Dave Zirin, everybody.
Sterling, that's the accountability.
There you go. There you go. You brought up an interesting topic, which is fan ownership. So let's talk a little bit about football. Explain the Green Bay Packers model of team ownership and how it's different from private ownership. What are the good points? What are the bad points?
Well, interestingly, one of the good points relates to something we talked about in the very beginning, which is that every year they release the full disclosure of the financial figures of how the team did to the city. And that's one thing about it, which is very nice. The second thing is, yeah, they're my favorite owners in sports, all 112,000 of them. There are 112,000 shareholders of the Green Bay Packers. You own a share in the Packers, you don't pull a profit off of it. You don't pull a dividend off of that stock. You get a piece of paper that says you're a part owner of the Packers. You don't even get a frame to put the piece of paper in. I talk to people on the board of directors of the shareholders who also don't pull a profit. They joke to me that they have to buy their own frames to put it up in their office. And they're proud of that fact. So that's one way that they run. The second way they run is that they have articles of incorporation that ensure that the team will never leave Green Bay. So you're never going to see any BS in Green Bay like, oh, you better build us a new stadium or we're going to become the Oklahoma City Packers. That BS is completely out of the equation. which is welcome, because it means sports then can't be used to terrorize taxpayers into giving up more of their money into the corporate till. But the last thing about them that I find particularly appealing as a fan is that when you go to games and you spend the steep prices on things like beer, hot dogs, programs, a portion of that money goes into charity, into local charity. And so you have a sense when you go to a game that you're actually supporting your community. And in far too many cities, you go to a game and you feel like you're part of the problem. You're part of an institution that's actually hurting the city instead of helping it. And in Green Bay, they've taken that and really turned it on its head.
We're talking to Dave Zirin, everybody, author of the book Bad Sports. It's very rare that I come out with such a glowing endorsement, but if you want a fun, humorous read, pick this book up. Dave, we're almost out of time. This is one of my quick-fire questions for you. It's pretty much just a yes or no before I let you go, and that is, back to baseball, Don Fleer, who used to be the president of the Players Union, should he be in the Hall of Fame, yes or no?
Not until his boss, Marvin Miller, is, so no.
Okay. Fair enough. All right, everybody. We've been talking to Dave Zirin, and he is the author of the book Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Game We Love. And that pretty much brings us to the end of another show. You've been listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We're on every day, Monday through Friday at 10 o'clock here on KKZZ AM 1400. Coming up next is Living Your Inspired Life with Susan Burrell. We end each show by saying, go out and be the change you want to see in the world. Remember, the leaders of the past didn't hold with today's conventions, and neither will the leaders of tomorrow. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Well, it's a marvelous night for a moon.